Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're glad you're with us today. It's been less than a week since Hurricane Michael made landfall as a Category 4 storm. More than 200,000 homes remain without power, and in many communities, few homes even remain standing. But for Americans living in the path of these hurricanes, the past few years have been devastating. There have been four Category 4 hurricanes in the past two storm seasons, from Harvey to Irma to Maria and now Michael. And that means some are still responding to one disaster when another one hits.
My name is Jody. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a nurse and I volunteer with the Red Cross. I was only home for 2 weeks from my deployment to Eastern North Carolina for Hurricane Florence when Hurricane Michael hit. I'm still participating in the relief efforts locally, coordinating nursing for shelters in my area for people who have lost power. After this winds down, I have been asked to return to Durham to work on Hurricane Florence again, and then I may try to go to Florida. It has been an exhausting couple of months.
As the disasters keep coming, so do the challenges of rebuilding. And climate experts say the storms are not going to let up. In fact, it's just the opposite. Today, we'll take a look at what hurricanes like Michael tell us about our own weaknesses, from building codes to community efforts. Craig Fugate was FEMA administrator from 2009 to 2017. He's seen the country through Hurricane Sandy and a host of other disasters. But before that, he was head of emergency management for the state of Florida. Craig, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Craig, one of the things that's become clear after Michael is we really need to assess building codes. Can you tell us why and how that is?
Well, probably the one storm that really showed Florida the need for better building codes and better enforcement was Hurricane Andrew. Tremendous damage, but in the aftermath, we saw that a lot of the construction wasn't even being built to the codes in the community. And so we learned that both the codes are important, but also the enforcement and inspection of those codes were critical.
And when you talk about storm surge as one of the biggest concerns, does that indicate in your experience that folks should not be thinking about building along the coast at this point?
Well, I think we have to be very careful about how we build along the coast. I think in many areas, particularly if you look at this part of Florida's coast, storm surge is measured in 10 feet and higher in many areas, and it goes well inland. So probably building right on the water's edge maybe not be the best place. But if we build appropriately, we elevate structures, it doesn't mean we cannot develop, but it means we're just not going to be able to build like we've done in the past. The other challenge we have with all this is not going to be inexpensive. In this part of the state, this is a lot of older Florida. Folks have lived here for generations. And as we talk about resiliency, I do have one concern, and that is as much as it's going to cost us to rebuild this coast, are we going to create a society of resilience based upon wealth and funding and displace people who can't afford that? Or are we going to look at how we can build resiliency in our coast and not leave out the working class?
I think that's really the big question. We seem to see this happening over and over again in many of the storms that hit us. I'm thinking about Katrina. I'm thinking about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Thinking obviously about now in Michael. The economic differences really stand out. Are there structural issues after these storms that stand out to you in terms of, particularly when we look at lower income communities?
Yeah, the one that really sticks out in the front end is the insurance and lack of it, particularly flood insurance, but also because wind insurance is very expensive in Florida. Many times people have high deductibles for that wind damage. It's not uncommon for people who own their homes, have lived there for generations, who cannot afford to repair their homes or bring them up to code because their insurance isn't there or isn't covering the losses. And most of our federal programs aren't really designed in mind of how do we make sure, and again, you know, I'm not just talking about low income. I'm talking about people that work, you know, nurses, paramedics, firefighters, sheriff's deputies, police officers, school teachers, people that work down at the local, you know, hardware store. These are, you know, essential workforce for these communities. Yet in many cases along the beaches and these coastal communities where they live, they're being priced out as the cost of rebuilding is so high but also as investors see opportunity to go in and develop these areas.
Well, we saw a lot of that in Miami, actually. Our team was down reporting there earlier this summer, and we saw that there were places that were essentially gentrifying as people were moving inland to try and, live places where they weren't going to be affected by hurricanes.
Yeah, and throughout the state of Florida, particularly in the 04 and 05 hurricanes, I saw this tendency that we were displacing the working class, we were displacing the poor in the name of new development that was oftentimes being built on top of areas that had been devastated in the previous hurricanes.
Craig Fugate is former FEMA administrator and former head of emergency management for the state of Florida. Craig, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's turn now to the future. How can we design communities to be more resilient in the face of climate change? Here to help us figure this out is Thad Miller, a professor at the School for Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University. Thanks for joining us, Thad.
Thank you for having me.
So, Thad, we hear this word resilience lobbed around left and right when we're talking about building our cities. What are we talking about? What does that actually mean?
Right. That's a great question, one that cities are grappling with right now. And I think there's a tendency to focus on the hard infrastructure when we think about resilience. And it is that. But it's also about how our environmental systems are positioned. For example, wetlands that had been eroded before Katrina came actually contributed to a worse storm. But it's also our social systems. So that means both the ability of communities to bounce back and to come together before, during, and after an event. But it's also how our organizations are able to create more resilient communities and infrastructure and respond to those events.
And when we think about infrastructure, I mean, with our previous guests, we talked a little bit about these, the Category 4 storms. We've had four in the past couple of storm seasons. We're seeing lots of damage to infrastructure and lots of attempts at building back. Should we be trying to build things that will withstand anything and everything that nature will throw at us? Or are you seeing resilience as something that, perhaps might fail and be able to bounce back more quickly?
Right. I think, that will depend on where you are and community needs. And then I think it'll end up being both strategies. There may be infrastructure in place that you just have to say, we cannot move this power plant right now, or at least not for the next 30 years. So we have to make sure that nuclear system, for example, is protected. But there may be other examples where after a storm, it does make more sense to give more room to the river or to give more room to the shoreline. And you see that happening in places from Staten Island in New York City all the way to the Columbia River and discussions with cattle farmers about how do we let this flood but then compensate you if it does.
And one of the things that comes up often when we're talking about disaster recovery is cost. You mentioned Staten Island here in New York. There are still some folks who are trying to recover from Hurricane Sandy, which feels like it was eons ago. Obviously, we're looking, we see folks dealing with Michael and dealing with Hurricane Maria. Who is supposed to pay for this type of resilience? Who do you see as responsible for the long-term recovery of these places? And where does the burden really fall here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure that I have the perfect answer other than to say I think it's all hands on deck. I know New York after Sandy has been lucky in the sense that they've been able to bring both local funding for that, but also federal funding. But other cities who maybe haven't had a recent disaster, right, and then therefore don't have the attention or maybe the access to the federal funding for recovery that a New York or others might have, are still trying to think about how to fund this so that we're resilient in advance of an event, and so that they don't have the next Sandy happen to them, for example. And so that is about what our local organizations and local taxpayers willing to bear to prepare for weather and climate.
Well, I think that's the big question, because when we think about this, I often think, what should we you know, about resilience. I mean, is it a question that we have to ask ourselves even more difficult questions about where we decide to build at all? I'm thinking about the coastlines. I'm thinking about places that are much more likely to be affected. Should taxpayers be, you know, dealing with that burden if they themselves aren't the ones who are building in these more precarious areas? Like, who does the burden really fall on at that point? If I decide, if my home is destroyed and then I decide to build it back, you know, aren't I taking the risk of having it destroyed again?
Right, exactly. And in some cases, maybe it is that those shoreline properties that are wealthier neighborhoods, as you were talking with your previous guest. But in other cases, it may be communities that don't really have the resources to recover or to build back because that neighborhood was known as a low-lying inland flooding neighborhood and no one else wanted to live there. And so it became a lower income area. And so I think it depends. And you pointed out with your previous guest as well that the insurance system is a big part of this. And I think there's going to have to be discussions between, you know, federal and local levels and insurance companies about how to best create a system that is resilient, right? It's not just the hard infrastructure that needs to be resilient, but it's also these other systems, including insurance and economic systems that need to go into this as well.
Right. And also city planning. I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these cities that a lot of the places we live in, as you mentioned, initially probably were not dealing with these forces like they're dealing with now. What do you think it would take to actually climate proof our communities? Is that even possible? I mean, I know we're reporting on the fact that in the next couple of decades, if we don't do something soon, we're in a bad situation here climate wise.
For sure. Yeah. And I think the key point there is that it's not that planners and engineers haven't thought about climate and weather. It's just that the climate and weather that they've built into infrastructure over the past 50 plus years, that knowledge is now outdated and it's built for climate and weather patterns that really no longer exist. Yet the stormwater pipes that you put in the ground 50 or 75 years ago still have to function now with a different climate. And I think planners, engineers, et cetera, at the city level are increasingly realizing this. And it's a real issue whether they're going to be tackling with it under something called resilience or an office of resilience, or they're just thinking together about and noticing the changes in weather patterns and how to more effectively deal with this, knowing that the future is not going to be like the past.
Thad, briefly, do you see any hope here? I'm thinking of the subways in New York City now that when it rains, it almost rains underground at this point because our infrastructure is so broken.
Right. I mean, I do see some hope that maybe that's more my personality, but I think cities increasingly see this as fundamental, and cities and communities want their infrastructure to work so they can be economically competitive, healthy, vibrant places. I think cities see this as something that is, about their fundamental sustainability moving forward.
Thad Miller is a professor at the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University, and he co-leads the Urban Resilience Sustainability Research Network, which is funded by the National Science Foundation. Tensions are high between Saudi Arabia and its critics following the disappearance and suspected murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In a statement, Khashoggi's family has called for an independent and impartial international commission to investigate the circumstances of his death. Khashoggi is not the first Saudi dissident to be targeted for being critical of the Saudi regime, but his death is raising questions about the United States' close financial ties with the kingdom. Last week, a group of bipartisan senators called for sanctions and an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia, but the U.S.'s complex relationship with their government goes back to the 1930s when oil exploration began in the kingdom. Joining us to discuss the economic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is Ben Freeman. He's the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the basics. What is the economic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, and what are some of the major commodities that we tend to exchange?
Well, as you mentioned, the economic relationship goes back decades, and it's founded on oil, basically. The Saudis sit on one of the largest oil deposits in the world and have been one of the leading exporters of oil for decades. But recently, they've realized that those oil reserves aren't going to last forever, and so they've taken steps to try and diversify their economy. Also, another factor in it is that the U.S. is producing more and more oil through fracking and other means that make it less reliant on Saudi oil. And so in some cases, the Saudis have diversified that economy to other areas, including arms manufacturing and buying military arms and bombs and planes from the U.S.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about those defense contractors, because Reuters reported a couple days ago that they were quite concerned with the idea of sanctions. And I'm going to play a clip here from President Trump talking to Leslie Stahl about that issue this week on 60 Minutes.
Would you consider imposing sanctions as a bipartisan group of senators have proposed?
Well, it depends on what the sanction is. I'll give you an example. They are ordering military equipment.
So would you cut that off?
I tell you what I don't want to do. Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, all these I don't want to hurt jobs. I don't want to lose an order like that. There are other ways of punishing, to use a word that's a pretty harsh word, but it's true.
So we looked up the financial statements for Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon, three of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the United States, and we found that they made a lot of money. I mean, combined, they reported more than $169 billion in revenue for 2017. But Trump has said that under his administration, there have been more than $100 billion worth of arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Is that even accurate?
Yeah, part of the problem with the president's argument is that it starts with a number that's not actually based in reality. It's, to use his term, it's fake news. This $110 billion in arms sales to Saudi Arabia, it's realistically never a number that's going to materialize. Last year, we sold less than $10 billion to Saudi Arabia. So I have no real idea where the other $100-plus billion in arms sales is supposed to come from. The other problem with the idea is that arms sales are not a great jobs creator. A lot of these firms that he's mentioning, you know, your Lockheed Martins and your Raytheons, at the same time their revenues have been going up, they've actually been cutting jobs here in the U.S. And some of these jobs have been going overseas to places like Saudi Arabia. So the net economic impact to the U.S., I think, is negligible at best. So the idea of saying that if we cut off these arms sales, it'll cripple the U.S. economy, I think at the very least, that's hyperbolic.
So, Ben, how about President Trump and the Trump Organization? What personal economic stake do they have in Saudi Arabia?
They have immense personal stakes in Saudi Arabia. In fact, it goes back decades between Trump and Saudi Arabia. He's been doing business there for at least two decades that we know of. He's famously said things like, well, he loves the Saudis. They buy $20, $30, $40 million condos in some of his hotels. During the campaign alone, he started 8 new businesses in Saudi Arabia related to hotel ventures there. And mind you, that was just during the course of his less than 2-year campaign. So you fast forward to when Trump takes office and the Saudis start this great lobbying and PR enterprise. And they capitalize on a lot of that. They know Trump has not fully divested from his businesses, and they know they can use that as leverage against him.
What would sanctions or could sanctions look like that would actually have an impact from a business standpoint?
I think there's a lot of options for sanctions. I think it's important for folks to realize that it's the U.S. that has the advantage here, not the Saudis. The Saudis rely much more on us than we rely on Saudi Arabia. As I mentioned previously, they're trying to diversify their economy right now. In this conference that has been reported in the news, the so-called Davos in the Desert conference that's planned for a couple weeks from now, a lot of American businesses have already pulled out from that, and other foreign businesses too. Richard Branson pulled out from it, for example. And so even independent of what Congress does with sanctions, I think you're already seeing plenty of blowback from the business community. And I think that's only going to continue if the Saudis continue this very misleading storyline that they've been on.
Can you tell us about Saudi economic influence inside the United States, especially when it comes to lobbying our lawmakers? Do you think that that's something that will prevent sanctions?
In 2017, when Donald Trump was elected president, the Saudis really doubled down on their already very large lobbying and public relations campaign that they were running in the U.S. in 2016, for example, they spent a little under $10 million on lobbying in public relations firms. By the end of 2017, they had spent over $27 million that year. So you see almost this tripling of their influence operation. And what they did, they hired a lot of lobbying and public relations firms with folks that were close to the Trump administration and just other large, very well-connected firms on both the Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle. My organization has documented many instances where lawmakers took campaign contributions from Saudi lobbyists on the exact same day they met with them. But I think despite that, there's a very good chance that Congress will actually pass sanctions, and they might also punish the Saudis in other ways, including cutting off arms sales and cutting off U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen.
And very briefly, do you see this having any impact on the markets, Ben?
The Saudi markets, for sure. We've already seen some pretty dramatic impacts on the Saudi economy. But in terms of the U.S. economy, again, we just don't rely that much on Saudi Arabia economically for business ventures yet. Certainly in the arms manufacturing industry, Saudi Arabia is the number one buyer of U.S. military equipment and arms sales. But I think there's plenty of non-economic reasons to question those to begin with. The war in Yemen has been declared the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, and U.S. bombs have been found to have killed civilians in that conflict. So to stop those bombs from flowing to Saudi Arabia could protect the lives of civilians in Yemen.
Ben Freeman is the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
Last week, the Supreme Court declined to hear a case out of North Dakota that requires people to show ID with a residential address in order to vote. This decision places a significant burden on Native communities who live on reservations, often without a street address. We covered that story on Monday's show. But the challenges these communities face when attempting to register to vote or to cast a ballot extend far beyond North Dakota. In 2012, only two-thirds of American Indians and Alaska Natives were registered, 7 percentage points lower than their white counterparts. The turnout rate for registered Native voters is also lower. Jacqueline DeLeon is a member of Isleta Pueblo and staff attorney at Native Americans Rights Funds, and she joins me now. Jacqueline, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's break down some of the main issues that are preventing Native Americans from voting.
I think one of the biggest issues are just structural issues. You know, reservations are often remote, and there are significant distances that Native Americans are being forced to travel in order to cast their ballot. Even when they request polling locations, those requests are being denied. And so we've been hearing throughout Indian country that it's not uncommon to have to travel 20, 40 miles to vote. And there are some egregious examples. For example, in Nevada, in Duck Valley, voters have to travel as far as 150 miles round trip in order to cast a vote, which equates to, on a good day, about 4.5 hours of travel time.
One of the things that we noticed in North Dakota was that this ruling essentially would bar or make it more difficult for people with just a P.O. box address to vote rather than those that have a residential street address. Is that something that you're seeing in other states?
Yes, it's starting to become a problem. There is a housing crisis on Native American reservations. In 2017, for about 11,000 members of the Northern Arapaho in Wyoming, there were just 230 reservation homes, which led to averaging about 48 people per home. And so this housing crisis is creating a problem where Native Americans don't have residential street addresses because they're moving from home to home, but also in these remote areas, those homes may not even have an address on them to begin with. And so it's literally impossible for people to comply with a residential street address requirement. And instead, they're depending upon P.O. boxes, which have a lot of flaws in order to conduct their affairs. And so these kind of barriers to housing are going to start translating to barriers to the ballot box if we don't create a system that doesn't rely on residential street addresses.
Why are we only having this conversation now? I feel like the timing of this decision and everything else just seems like there should be some system in place for this community. I mean, this isn't something that just happened the other day.
No, I mean, the Native American Rights Fund, we've been litigating this case since 2014. We saw in that election, we saw widespread disenfranchisement of the Native community. And so, you know, we immediately filed suit. We received relief from the law in 2016 because the federal district court found that it was, in fact, discriminatory. And that had a burdensome impact on Native Americans. The legislator slightly tweaked the law in 2017. The district court again found that that law was discriminatory because it kept the discriminatory features, which are the residential address and the, you know, IDs that were, you know, really strict in number and hard to get. You know, Native American issues are often underreported. You know, over the past year, we've conducted a series of field hearings around Indian country to sort of ask, what are these barriers that are keeping you from voting? And this is, you know, one of the first times that these communities had been asked that question.
Jacqueline DeLeon is a member of the Isleta Pueblo and staff attorney at Native American Rights Fund. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
In a video released this week, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren backed up her long-contested claim that she has Native American ancestry, with results from a DNA test and a telling of her family's story.
My mother was born in eastern Oklahoma. It had been Indian territory until just a few years earlier when it had become a state. My daddy always said he fell head over heels in love with my mother the first time he saw her. But my daddy's parents, the Herrings, were bitterly opposed to their marrying because my mother's family, the Reeds, was part Native American.
President Trump has long taunted Warren's claims of Native ancestry and even nicknamed her Pocahontas. The accusations surrounding Warren's ancestry date back to 2012 when her Republican challenger for the Senate, Scott Brown, accused Warren of using her Native American heritage to advance her career. Graham Lee Brewer is a contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News and a member of the Cherokee Nation. Hi, Graham.
Hi.
What was your reaction to Elizabeth Warren's decision to take this test and put out this video?
I thought it was very interesting. I want to be very clear. I'm not here to discredit her story or the common knowledge of her family that she's been passed down. I was more concerned about the way it was talked about and I think the method. This conversation with Elizabeth Warren and also President Trump has been very problematic from the beginning. And I think using a DNA test to validate that history was probably the wrong approach.
It's interesting there because you don't want to criticize, I guess, her intentions for doing this, but then it was actually what she did, right? The method, the way that it was done. Was the issue a DNA test itself? Was it that it was covered by the media inappropriately?
I think it's all of the above. When we're covering Indian country, when we're covering tribal communities, we have to take not just a look at the language we use, but the way we talk about them. The problem I had with Senator Warren's approach was that it kind of fosters a narrative that is damaging to Native people. To give you a little bit of context, I have a very similar story to Senator Warren. I am not much darker than she is outwardly. The place where that video is shot is probably just a couple miles from my home. I live in Norman, Oklahoma. That's where I'm talking to you from now. And so I don't fault her for wanting to know more about her history. In fact, I would encourage her to do so. But I think when you invite people to talk about the degree of your blood quantum, which is the degree of your Indian blood, which is something that is documented by the government, in my case, certainly, you're opening up to conversations that feed into stereotypes and myths about Native people. Blood quantum is a very thorny subject. It's an institution of colonialism. It was something that was put in place to essentially weed out our levels of Native blood. So by putting a stop on the degree to which you're allowed to join your tribe, which is a choice that tribes are able to make as they are sovereign nations, then it makes it less likely that your children will be able to be tribal members if they don't have the same amount of Indian blood as you do. My tribe, for instance, the Cherokee Nation, we don't have a blood quantum. So as long as you can prove lineage, you are a member. To say that someone who is 1/8 has more of a say or is more Native than someone who is 1/32, for instance, I think is wrong. We're not just talking about a racial distinction here. We're talking about a political distinction. This is a citizenship question. I am a citizen of a sovereign nation as well as being a descendant of an indigenous person.
Can you help us understand a little bit more when you talk about blood quantum? What does that mean in the Native American community?
So when the government put many of us on the Trail of Tears, my great-great-great-grandfather, for instance, they wrote his name down, where he was from, and where he was headed to. That record still stands, and it makes it easier to trace my lineage back to my Cherokee roots. That way, I can show the nation that I am a descendant of this person, I am a member of this nation, and I can be enrolled as such. Now, some tribes have blood quantum in place. My son, for instance, is also part Kiowa. The Kiowa Nation of Oklahoma, you have to be 1/4 Kiowa to join. The Navajo Nation is similar. But when it comes to DNA tests, I think we need to keep in mind that a DNA test doesn't prove that you are Native American. There is no DNA test to say definitively you are an indigenous person. When it comes to tribal issues, DNA tests are used to show who your parents are, to show that lineage, to show that you are a descendant of this person. It's not a test that you can take to say, yes, I am Kiowa, or I am Cherokee, or I am Navajo.
I'm wondering, in terms of the media coverage of this, did you feel like Native perspectives were being included in the reaction to Senator Warren's decision to release this video?
I felt like there was a lot of attention given to Senator Warren and how she feels about Trump's rhetoric towards her, which I will agree is not okay. It's not acceptable the way President Trump speaks to her about race. But I felt there was more emphasis on how Senator Warren was affected by it rather than how her response affects indigenous people. I think her response helps foster this narrative that, like I said, her blood quantum is important, or that a DNA test can prove that you're indigenous. Neither one of those things are true. In reactions I have seen from indigenous scholars, writers, and just regular tribal members off the street is mostly one of anger. They're not happy with the way that this has shaped the public discussion. They don't feel like Senator Warren has made efforts to understand them or their perspective. And they feel, again, like their own narrative is being perverted in the public eye. I think we need to keep in mind that when we're talking about indigenous communities, we're talking about some of the most isolated communities in the country. And I don't just mean physically. Yes, some of those communities are isolated physically, but there is an invisibility problem with Indian country. Non-Native people, by and large, don't understand Indian country. They don't understand sovereignty. They don't understand tribal membership. And they don't understand, like I was saying, that this is a citizenship question as well as a racial distinction. I think all of those things together just compound the problem of misperception and stereotype that permeates popular culture when it comes to Native American people.
Graham Lee Brewer is a reporter with the High Country News and a member of the Cherokee Nation. Graham, thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tanzina Vega. Welcome back to The Takeaway. In our next conversation, a warning. Talk of violence may be disturbing to some listeners.
Take this one!
On Friday night, a fight erupted outside an event at the Metropolitan Republican Club on Manhattan's Upper East Side. Activists had gathered to protest the event where alt-right leader Gavin McGinnis, founder of the far-right group The Proud Boys, had been invited to speak. After the event, the Proud Boys clashed with protesters, and cell phone footage shows the agitators bragging about the night's bloody outcome.
By the time I got there,
I hit him.
That's right.
That's right, baby.
Fight on our streets.
I ripped that motherfucking mask off and kick him right in the head. Son of a bitch. Get the fuck
back. They say he's a foreigner, if you weren't able to hear it. Photographer Shay Horse, who was at the scene, tweeted, quote, "I haven't seen a fight that violent in a long time. The Proud Boys were totally ready and willing to be violent tonight. They didn't even wear masks." It wasn't the only incident of violence involving the group over the weekend. On the other side of the country, in Portland, Oregon, the Proud Boys got into an even larger fight with a local far-left group who considered themselves Antifa. Here to help us make sense of all this is Tanya Hernandez, professor of law at Fordham University and the author of the forthcoming book Multiracials and Civil Rights, and David Nywert, author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, and a correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tanya and David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, likewise.
David, let's start with you. For those who don't know who the Proud Boys are, what's their agenda?
Basically, they want to engage in street violence against radical leftists and Antifa folks, as they like to call them. They're street brawlers, and they want to go out there and fight and defend Donald Trump and the radical right.
We definitely know that the street brawling element, we saw that happen in New York City and, of course, in Portland. But tell us a little bit about Gavin McGinnis. This is somebody who is a very prominent media executive here in New York City, no?
Yeah. No, he's been doing very well. I mean, he's one of the co-founders of Vice. And, of course, he left in, I think, 2014, something like that. He's a very savvy media manipulator. And he has a regular show that is very popular with the alt-right.
And I'm wondering, what types of folks are signing up, or, if you will, where are the members of this group coming from? Who are becoming members of the Proud Boys?
Well, typically, you know, white males between the ages of 15 and 30. That's who they're recruiting. And it's right-wing males. And, you know, I mean, geographically, most of them are coming from the suburbs and exurbs. But it's pretty widespread.
Tanya, I want to bring you in here. Let's talk about the history, a little bit about the history of where the Proud Boys fit into our history with hate groups. I was thinking back to when I was growing up in New York City and there were quote-unquote skinheads and you saw them every now and then. But are the Proud Boys unique?
I think they're a part of our shift in culture. And what I mean by that is, to say white supremacy in our most recent past was to trigger a notion of white pride and all kinds of hatred against even the idea of racial integration. Our move over time, right, has been to, as a nation, embrace a sense of, oh, no, we're more than just white and we can take pride in being more than just white. So what is so fascinating, and I have to say disturbing, about the Proud Boys and some of these other youth culture pro-white organizations is that they're actually attracting men of color and men who identify as mixed race as well. Part of that that I find so disturbing is that it enables the organizations to say, see, we're not racist. We're just pro-white as a culture. And anybody who wants to join that is welcome to join us, including these men of color who are sort of also very much enamored of the idea of whiteness as a status. And also the key binary here is that anti-blackness is a key feature of their platform.
What is the driving force behind men, and in particular some men of color, to have joined this group? Is it racism? Is it misogyny? Is it both?
It is both. I mean, talk about a paradigmatic intersectional example. That is the conflation together of both anti-gender bias and race bias. The ways in which this is, I guess, you know, you would say very toxic white masculinity, right? And men of color are no exception to sort of being seduced by the superficial power that offers up.
Is it becoming easier to sell in this current climate?
It is most definitely easy to sell because it combines both quotes of Martin Luther King about not being racist at the same time that it talks about whiteness as being a culture that is worth uplifting, as if you could take away from this racism.
I'm just curious how it is that people of color who are not by definition white can engage with that type of thinking.
Because what they do is they disassociate this idea of whiteness as culture from racism. And any anti-blackness is also reduced to the idea of, oh, it's not about blackness, it's about bad black culture.
David, what's your sense of that? I mean, are you seeing, is this a new form of hate group ideology that we're seeing across the United States?
Well, in some ways, it's actually very old. I mean, I started doing this when I was covering the Aryan Nations in Idaho in the late 70s and early 80s, and they too claimed that they were only pro-white. And it's one of the realities of white supremacist groups is that, you know, they'll claim to just be pro-white and defending white interests, but inevitably their pro-white advocacy becomes attacks on other races. But that's not how they sell themselves. And of course, what really is the underlying dynamic here is less white supremacism than authoritarianism. And that's what they're selling. And authoritarianism crosses all kinds of racial and ethnic and religious boundaries. You know, we've got one of our main sort of Proud Boy groups out here on the West Coast is called Patriot Prayer. And they're headed by a guy who's Japanese American, and his right-hand man is this big Samoan guy. So, yeah, we get, and I see all kinds of non-white guys joining their ranks. But when I talk to them, every one of them has what we call a right-wing authoritarian personality.
Tanya, you wanted to weigh in here.
Well, David, I just wanted to throw in the idea that it's not new, but yes, it is in some respects. And in as much as that now these white supremacist groups are claiming to be welcoming to people of color, not just that their pro-whiteness is just about culture and that they're not actually racist, but they're okay with having non-white members be part of their bandwagon. And while they may be very much about authoritarianism, and I agree with you there, they're also spouting lots of pro-white rhetoric that I don't think we should, you know, be dismissing. That is to say, in as much as it's about authoritarianism, it doesn't mean that it's not about race.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It is this very interesting mix. And it's also, it's an interesting mix of old and new because they're marketing it in ways that I mean, always the radical right was very backward looking. And this shape of the radical right is very savvy, very media savvy, and very forward looking, which is problematic.
Well, I also want to talk about the initial response to this here, at least in New York City. The NYPD, the New York Police Department, said on Monday that it did have plans to arrest 9 members of the Proud Boys and 3 more anti-fascist opponents. But footage from the fight that night shows the police arriving. They dispersed the crowds, but none of the Proud Boys actually were arrested. And there were some accusations that the police, the NYPD, didn't do enough to stop the attackers. There was also an assumption that there was support here from the implicit support for the Proud Boys from the NYPD. David, do you think there's a level of support within law enforcement for far-right groups like the Proud Boys?
Yes, I do. I believe that actually our law enforcement system throughout the country right now is being, you know, very heavily politicized by organizations like the Oath Keepers, which specifically, you know, this is essentially a patriot, very far-right organization that is recruiting law enforcement, and they're succeeding. So, yeah, I've been out covering a lot of these, and I would say Portland police in particular are very prone to acting in defense of the right-wing side and very much acting against they very much see the anti-fascists as the bigger problem. And I think that's a problem.
Tanya, your thoughts.
You know, what I find fascinating about this, David, is that I think another aspect of this is that even for the police officers who don't actually view themselves as being invested in this white supremacist authoritarianism, I think are very much swayed by the idea that what they are observing is just about free speech, right? That these folks are just spouting their ideas. And I think that's part of the underlying problem here is the stereotype of the United States as being so absolutist about free speech that you can say any kind of hateful thing on the street and it doesn't matter. And it doesn't seem to mean that it results in violence, although history shows us how intimately intertwined racist speech is with racist violence.
I do want to point out that we did reach out to the NYPD, the Takeaway did, for comment about their response specifically to this incident and also the claim that Gavin McGinnis said that he actually was supported by the NYPD. So I'm going to read you a brief response from the NYPD. And they say that they called McGinnis an individual who's a provocateur who does not speak for the NYPD. They say the NYPD is a diverse institution dedicated to keeping safe all 8.5 million New Yorkers. Violence and disorder like what occurred on October 12th is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. And the statement does go on. So they did respond to this request. At the national level, what do you see? Do you see this as a trend that's going to continue to catch on? Is this something that'll go back underground? What's your experience tell you?
Yeah, my experience doesn't really help with this because this is all new. I think we all hope that it goes back underground, but I'm not very hopeful in that regard because I think this is very much a creature of the internet.
David Nyward is the author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, and a correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Tanya Hernandez is a professor of law at Fordham University and author of the forthcoming book, Multiracials and Civil Rights. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.